I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been a year since President Obama signed into law the two-phase bill to kickstart the economy and then increase jobs. Today, the administration released a graph showing how job loss had slowed, and the president defended the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for preventing a depression.
There has never been a program of this scale moved at this speed that has been enacted as effectively and as transparently as the Recovery Act.
Chris Saliza is national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Well, Chris, how are Republicans responding?
Robin, this is a huge fight politically and policy-wise, but a huge fight as we enter into 2010. The onus is on Democrats to sell this. I think what you'll see from Republicans and hear from Republicans is essentially what we've seen and heard so far, that this bill was not the right thing, that using the government to stoke the economy is not ultimately a long-term economic solution, that President Obama should have done more. The private industry, private enterprise, small businesses, he should have focused on that rather than dumping millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars into government spending programs.
Well, Democrats, including Vice President Joe Biden, were out on the morning talk shows saying that they agree that Americans don't realize what the stimulus program has done for them. But whose fault is that? I mean, we're thinking that new Republican Senator Scott Brown arrived in Washington and announced that not one new job was created, where all credible nonpartisan research firms say that 1.6 to 1.8 million jobs were added. You know, your thoughts on whether or not the Obama administration should have met some of those people?
They have not. I think it is beyond debate that the Obama administration has not sold this bill in any effective way, shape, or form. You know, Vice President Biden this morning said that the bill, that he acknowledged it hadn't been sold properly. Most people didn't know the good things that it had done, but he emphasized that much of the job creation elements of the bill were backloaded, that people would start to feel those in the spring and in the summer. If you're a vulnerable Democrat in the House or the Senate, you have to hope that Joe Biden is right, because I think one of the big problems for this administration is people feel as though they took their eye off the ball, that they went and tried to pass health care, which they still have yet to do, at a time when the economy and the job market were in close to collapse, and they did not focus on that enough. That is the fundamental problem. I think it's why you've seen independents leave the Democratic standard in large numbers in both, as you mentioned, the Scott Brown election, but also in governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia last year. So that's the problem they have to address. They have to hope that the policies put in place by the economic stimulus program do in fact now start to create jobs. And even more importantly, from a political perspective, that people believe and perceive that they're creating jobs. You know, there's reality and then there's perception in politics. Oftentimes, perception matters more. The perception is that things are not getting better. The CBS New York Times poll asked, do you think the economy is going to get better or get worse over the next year? 8% said better, 47% worse. That is a daunting number for the White House to tackle.
But as you said, nothing matters if you're the one who's hasn't got a job and that's what you're concentrating on. Just wondering, though, going into the midterms, the Republicans would seem to have that public opinion in their favor. But what about the thought that there might be backlash against them for seeming to not be behind anything the Obama administration is trying to do financially?
I think there's always a danger there, Robin, of that happening. But I would say that past history would suggest that midterm elections, particularly the first midterm of a presidency, tend to be a referendum on the party in power as opposed to the party out of power. There is an element, I think, that Republicans are relying on of being the other guy in politics. And sometimes being the other guy is the right place to be. If people want divided government, they want to send President Obama a message. I'm not convinced that Republicans have to offer detailed plans on each of these things. I don't know if the American people expect it. I think they may well say, you know what? We're not sure what Republicans stand for. We don't even know if we like them that much. But they're the other guy. We don't like the current guy all that much. Let's give someone else a try. Sometimes in politics, just being that other guy is enough.
Chris Saliza is national politics reporter for The Washington Post. He also writes their blog, The Fix, on the Post website. Chris, thanks so much.
Robin, thank you.
Well, analysts like David Leonhardt of the New York Times say that money that was passed in Congress in December and is directed toward aid to states and towns should create jobs, and that money can't come soon enough for many. New York City is facing a $3.5 billion shortfall for 2011. Mayor Bloomberg has proposed getting rid of four more firehouses on top of the 16 that are already closed. He's also proposed cutting library budgets. Boston is also considering closing libraries. In Los Angeles, fire crews and paramedic units units are taking a day off a week, and the city is looking to cut 1,000 other jobs to close a $200 million deficit. Well, today we want to touch down in three cities, all, it turns out, run by Republican mayors, all dealing with shortfalls in revenue. First to Colorado Springs, Colorado, where the city is shutting off a third of the city's streetlights, putting the police helicopters up for sale, cutting evening and weekend bus service, even asking residents to help mow lawns at neighborhood parks. Lionel Rivera is the mayor of Colorado Springs. Mr. Mayor, what's going on there?
Well, we derive about 65% of our revenues from sales tax. And when people start tightening their belts, they quit buying things. And that's what generates most of our revenue. And when the housing industry is in decline, all those building products don't generate sales tax revenue either. So we're in a tough situation, not much different than, you know, cities up in Europe, part of the woods, in the Northeast, New York and Philadelphia.
Well, many of your residents are concerned. When the lights are turned off, they're worried about safety. I got a quote here because the Denver Post spoke to people, and they quoted Addie Hansen, a college student, as saying, she doesn't know a person in the city who doesn't think that cutting the lights is the stupidest thing on the planet.
Well, you know, depending on what part of town you live in, those folks who live in the foothills along the mountain have actually many times told us that they don't want lights in their neighborhood because it messes with their ability to see the stars at night. Police department, traffic engineers, and our utilities are working very closely to ensure that we have the correct lighting at critical intersections, hospitals, and those areas where we really need them.
And we know you tried, and this gets to the heart of the matter, we know you tried raising some taxes to raise revenue, a tripling of the property tax in November. The voters really turned that down.
We in the state of Colorado have to get voter approval for tax increases. And, you know, the message to us is citizens are telling us, city, you need to tighten your belt and you need to focus on priority services. And, you know, that's what we're doing. We pretty much had to cut across the board. But the parts of our budget that were least affected were police and fire. We didn't lay any firefighters off, any police officers off. We didn't close any fire stations. We still have great response times for both police and fire. Some of the routine things that they would do working with the neighborhood groups and helping in crime prevention is not going to get done as much as it had in the past. But we still are one of the safest cities in the country for a city our size.
Would you prefer that residents had raised taxes?
I was a supporter of the tax increase, and it wasn't a tripling or quadrupling of the tax. It was an incremental increase over 5 years. The end result would have been a much higher property tax level than we have now. In our community, it always boils down to what our citizens are directing us to do, and we got the message, so we have to cut back in a variety of areas.
So this is a tension that we're seeing, as you said, across the country and even on a federal level. What would you say to people who say, no taxes, period? I mean, there's this big movement across the country. If a candidate is at all talking about increasing taxes to make up for some of these huge deficits, they're being targeted.
I think people make a conscious decision on whether or not they can take more money out of their pocket to provide services the city provides, or whether they rather keep that and take care of their families. And in our community, they've told us what they want to do. And we have to live with that. And one of the things that we are faced with are rising pension costs. Some of these defined benefit plans that were put into place 30, 40 years ago, way before I ever got in politics, we are stuck with now. In our case, we had to put an additional $6 million into our pension plans to keep them actuarially sound for our police and firefighters. And we're projected to do that again in 2011. And if we have to do that, what that means is either salaries have to come down or people have to be laid off. But there are options. There's In our case, a statewide plan that is significantly cheaper than what the city is doing, and then we have to work with our public safety employees to, I think, convince them that let's roll into a statewide plan, save the city $6 million, and be able to pay you a good wage and keep positions in place.
Well, and you mentioned salaries might have to come down. You know, there's been criticism. Again, the Denver Post reporting that a resort owner wrote an open letter asking why the city is spending upwards of $89,000 per employee. He says he only spends about $24,000 on employees.
You know, I appreciate the letter from the CEO from the Broadmoor Hotel, but frankly, $24,000 a year is not a living wage. And, you know, he operates differently than we do. I don't think you can pay public safety employees $24,000 per year and get a city that is safe. But he's right in one aspect. No doubt our average salaries are too high, not because the salary portion is high, but the benefits portion is too high. That is what we need to fix. And, you know, there are other options too. There are a lot of the things that the city does that don't necessarily have to be done by city employees. We have our neighborhood parks. Those are the ones that we're asking the communities to jump in to help us solve our issues.
Really, including, you know, rolling out their own lawnmower.
Well, absolutely. They want to do that to help us. We're not going to eliminate maintenance. We're going to continue to do the mowing. We're just not going to do as much maintenance as we had before, so the grass is going to be a little bit taller. And there might be some services the city currently provides that now we outsource and privatize, because, frankly, the private sector doesn't pay as generous of retirement benefits as we do, and it might be cheaper to outsource. So it's going to be a mix of, you know, the city employee taking care of public safety and some other key areas, and then partnerships and outsourcing to the private sector. But, you know, we all got to tighten our belts and figure out a smarter way to do things, and it may not be as pretty as some people would like, but we got to do it.
That's Lionel Rivera, mayor of Colorado Springs, Colorado, cash-strapped Colorado Springs. Mayor Rivera, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, let's turn to Indiana now. A new state law there is cutting property taxes and saving homeowners about $400 million statewide. And now the legislature has begun a five-year process to make those property tax cuts permanent in a constitutional amendment. Now, many residents are loving this idea, but what about towns and cities there? They're going to get less revenue from the state. Muncie, Indiana's Republican Mayor Sharon McShirley says, bring it on. Even though the property tax cut is costing her town between $3 and $8 million over the next few years, she joins us on the line now. And Mayor McShirley, what's your thinking there?
Well, it gives us an opportunity to really look at the core services that we provide and provide those and excel at them. We had a budget of $24 million that was dropped down to $19 million. So we had to cut $5 million last year. And then we're anticipating approximately $2 million as we move forward. And there were some pretty significant cuts that we had to make. For instance, we end up laying off 32 firefighters out of 110.
Yeah, we understand you also had to shut two of seven stations. That's reducing your fire department by 29%.
Yes, and then we also went in, though, and changed the protocol because our firefighters, even though we do not operate EMS out of our fire stations, was also going on non-emergency medical calls. So we changed our protocol and ultimately only increased our response time by 29 seconds.
This may resonate with some people. If you've called an ambulance in several cities, you know that sometimes you also get three fire trucks.
Correct.
And you're saying in Muncie, you decided maybe those three fire trucks weren't needed.
Correct. You know, if it's not life-threatening and we're going to be sending an ambulance with a paramedic on it anyhow, why are we sending our fire trucks?
That's Mayor Sharon McShirley of Muncie, Indiana. Fewer trucks on a call, though, is one thing. In addition to fewer firefighters, we understand her town also has cut police positions, turned a public park over to a private concern. We're going to take a break, and then we want to hear more from Mayor McShirley. We're also going to hear from the mayor of Pell City, Alabama. Now, they're located between Birmingham, Alabama, and Atlanta. And the mayor in Pell City did raise sales taxes, so we'll ask how that's going for him in this anti-tax climate. Later in the program, President Obama is going to meet with the Dalai Lama. Finally, we'll ask James Fallows about tomorrow's meeting. Back in 1 minute with Mayor McShirley of Muncie, Indiana, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversations with mayors across the country about how they're dealing with budget shortfalls. Before the break, Mayor Sharon McShirley of Muncie, Indiana, she says that state caps there on property taxes have actually helped her make her city government more efficient. But Mayor McShirley, what about schools? We know your school corporations or school districts are looking to cut about $5 million by reducing overtime, selling properties, holding off on new textbooks. How's that playing out?
The other question that really needs to be asked is how many school corporations do we have in our county? We have seven. It means we have seven superintendents. We have seven or more athletic directors. Everything's multiplied by seven. So really what we need to be looking at is, do we need seven school corporations or do we maybe need three?
You mean combine some?
And combine.
Aren't you talking then about people losing jobs?
Well, we are, but there are ways to do that through attrition. But, you know, ultimately there is going to be job losses from it. And doing that in a recession is not, obviously, is not the best timing. But at the same time, when the taxpayers are saying, we don't want to pay any more taxes, this has gotten out of control, And then, also with us being in a recession, I think you have to start looking at consolidating. It's just like us here in city government. We've had to go back, and I've challenged each department head. What is the core service that you are to be providing to the constituents here in the city of Muncie? And I think that that's what the school board is going to have to do. And that means there are going to be some changes. I was just talking to a fellow mayor, and she was telling me that she remembers growing up, and they didn't plow the streets. You know, now people are complaining because not only if we don't plow them, we're not going clear to the curb, you know, and getting into that kind of a detail on us as administrators. And so we've just become accustomed to having all these services, but now we have basically outpriced ourselves out of the market.
Well, you or your superintendent proposes doubling insurance costs for some non-union employees. So a single employee who pays 5% of their costs now, it would double to 10. Someone who pays 10 and a couple, it would double to 20. You could save $500,000 with that. But is that a place where, I mean, you talk to other mayors, health costs, is that a place where you're going to need to do something?
Definitely. Here's the issue. The public sector is paying anywhere between 25 to 40%. In my city here, I have employees that pay 8% of the cost. I could save $2 million by changing it and having all the employees pay 24%.
Well, some people would say that people can make more money in the private sector, and we should do everything we can to keep people in the public sector, including maybe help them more with their health costs.
And I would disagree with that. Small businesses are struggling. They're struggling to provide health insurance for their employees. They're struggling because the economy is down. We are in a position now where everything else has been just cut to the bare bone, and so now we will have to go after health insurance costs, and we'll all survive it. 6 months ago, everyone thought the sky was falling in Muncie, but then when we find out with the changes in the protocol, the closing of the two stations, ultimately our average response time only increased by 29 seconds. And so suddenly the sky's not falling, and we survived that crisis.
You're talking about cuts to the fire department.
Cuts to the fire department. People don't like change. They say they want change, and they like change as long as it doesn't affect them. If it's affecting someone else, then they're fine with it. And the attitude is, we'll do whatever you need to do. But people ultimately don't like change. But what I try to explain to my constituents is the world is always changing. It's just a matter of how we are able to adjust to it.
That's Sharon McShirley, a mayor of Muncie, Indiana. Mayor McShirley, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Now let's turn now to Pell City, Alabama, where the mayor and city council last week voted to raise the sales tax from 9 to 10% to offset Alabama's traditionally low property taxes, lowest in the country. Bill Herford is mayor of Pell City's 18,000 residents. So, Mayor, how did people respond to your sales tax hike?
Amazingly, it went very well. We held public hearings, two of them, and each of them were very well attended. And the great majority of the people that came understood the need that we had and were actually supportive.
Well, we understand some of the people who were against it said that they were worried that a higher sales tax would send people to other towns to shop. Are you worried about that?
I'm not really worried about it because we're the fourth city in our area to do this. We're hardly on the cutting edge.
Why did you even consider raising the sales tax? What's going on there?
First thing we did when we went into office about a year and a half ago now was to, every way that we could because of the recession, to reduce our expenses. And when we realized that we'd done all we could do, then it came time to consider raising the tax in order to pay for some $20.5 million in additional debt that we had incurred to rehabilitate our sewer system, to increase the size or capacity of our water system, and to build a new hospital.
You had capital expenses.
Big ones.
So, I mean, here you are, a Republican mayor in this town. It's a nonpartisan city council. But the word that we're hearing is that this is a dangerous thing to do, that, you know, raising taxes is just not to be considered. What would you say to people outside of the city? We've heard from other mayors as well about how that mantra feels to you.
Well, I think, you know, the first thing you say to people is, and I think you owe it as an elected official to say, we have done everything that we can to avoid raising taxes. And once we felt that we had covered all those things, then it became something that we had to do to very simply pay our bills.
Be fiscally responsible.
That's exactly what it is.
Have you had to cut services?
We have not had to cut services, and we have not laid off any employees. We have a number of volunteers in our city that step up and do things that the city had been doing.
Like what?
Our civic organizations have all stepped up. One took on Toys for Children, which is a project the city had done through our Parks and Rec Department. This year, the Civitans took it over. We needed a new audio system in our Civic Center, and the Rotary Club bought that. And Kiwanis has built a pavilion in our city park. Those are the kinds of things that you just can't measure.
And by the way, were you seeing a decrease in your revenue from a sales tax? Were people buying less? Is the recession part of this?
Yes, our overall revenues were down. Not terribly, but they were down. It really was the increase in debt service that we're facing that, is the big item here.
That's Bill Herford, mayor of Pell City, Alabama. He and the city council just approved a sales tax hike from 9 to 10%. Mayor Herford, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks to all our mayors for our roundup today. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, there are no small parts, this year's nominees for Best Supporting Oscars. And still ahead today, out there, art critic Dave Hickey. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. You don't have to be skinny to be successful. That's the message Spain wants to send its younger citizens by prohibiting ads from promoting certain beauty products and treatments on television before 10 o'clock at night. A new law passed recently by Parliament prevents the promotion of products or procedures that suggest surgical or chemical ways to achieve a perfect body. The law was prompted by concern that that kind of pressure was fueling a rise in eating disorders in young people in Spain. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reports from Madrid.
Some Spaniards will go a long way to be beautiful. A doctor at an elite clinic in Madrid prods and squeezes a woman's face as he decides where to inject her with acid. Filling in wrinkles this way and puffing up pouts are just a few of the services on offer here, all part of the idea this industry trades on, that success and good looks are firmly linked. The clinic's busy, so it's clearly a popular notion. Staff here say Spain performs the highest number of aesthetic surgeries in Europe, but a new law will now restrict TV adverts for such treatments for fear they're creating complexes in children. Dr. Ángel Martín Hernández disagrees.
I don't think it damages a child to say we offer hair removal or aesthetic surgery. We're just promoting a product like any other. As long as we're not showing pornography or misleading anyone, I think our adverts should be allowed.
I chose breast enlargement, the first woman in the clinic's TV ad boasts. The next had laser liposculpting. The women float across the screen, all pouts and plunging cleavages. Soon, adverts like this will only be shown after 10 p.m., when vulnerable young people shouldn't be watching. The changes to the law restrict ads for all products that promote the cult of the body, as Spaniards call it, and can trigger eating disorders like anorexia. Parliament did consider banning adverts for low-fat food too, though that idea was overruled. So we showed the advert for Clínica Menorca to two teenage girls and asked them what they thought. They make it like an offer in a supermarket, Alba tells me. Like you can just reach out your hand and get a new body. Both girls agree with restricting adverts like these, but Andrea tells me images from TV series here are just as influential.
All the main women in the series always have perfect bodies, so children who don't have figures like that get a complex.
Florencia was one of those children. She spoke to us by telephone from Barcelona. She says she was 13 when she started refusing food and 15 when she became seriously ill with anorexia. First inspired by a character in a TV series, she then got advice on starving herself from the internet. Now recovered, Florencia feels the pressure to be slim in Spain is growing.
It seems like every advert on TV now is for slimming pills or diet products. They have a very strong influence on people who are already obsessed with their figure. It's like they're conditioning you to think a certain kind of body is good. With this new law, at least children won't see the ads from an early age, so they'll have less of an impact.
Spain is already a pioneer in this field. The government's done a deal with several high street clothing chains to ban the smallest dummies from their window displays. It also outlawed stick-thin models on the catwalk. So politician Francisco Jerez calls the advertising law an important next step.
The problem is that the media promotes a prototype of beauty that is not real, and this can affect the self-esteem of young people. We're not saying ban these adverts completely. It's about scheduling them for adults like pornography after a certain time.
Pressure to achieve the body beautiful won't disappear with the adverts, but the hope is it will ease, leaving teenage Spaniards to fret over fashion and pop music instead of tempting them with talk of slimming pills and surgery.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reporting from Madrid. Well, we'll be back in 30 seconds with James Fallows on the meeting between Obama and the Dalai Lama, here and now. President Obama will meet the Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, in the White House tomorrow after pointedly not meeting him last summer in advance of Obama's trip to China, the first U.S. president to decline meeting the Dalai Lama since 1991. And this time around, there are also strong objections from Beijing. China sees the Tibetan leader as a splittist, but the Dalai Lama says he doesn't want to break away. He just wants rights for Tibetans. So what does tomorrow's meeting mean for U.S.-China relations? James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He was based in China for 3 years. His book about that time is Postcards from Tomorrow's Square. And Jim, first of all, do you think the decision not to meet with the Dalai Lama last summer was a mistake? Because critics say that maybe it gave China the impression that it did have control over whether or not a president meets with the Dalai Lama. And maybe tomorrow's meeting is about reasserting that China doesn't.
I think in hindsight, there's a strong case that probably this was a mistake. With the information on hand at the time, I can see the case for postponing. The information on hand was that the Obama administration thought it had perhaps a better chance for a new start with the Chinese regime across the board on environmental issues, on financial issues, and a variety of other issues, and thought this would put a predictable irritant to one side before the president's trip to Beijing. As it happened, these contentious issues remain. The trip to Beijing did not really resolve them that much, and so it might have been wise to get this meeting out of the way, the meeting with the Dalai Lama.
But do you think there's any signal being sent out to China tomorrow other than, you know, this is the meeting we were going to have and now we're having it?
I think that is the signal, and it's one of a range of entirely foreseeable irritants between the U.S. and China, which every administration goes through. For example, there's been really serious protests from the mainland government over the last month and a half or so about the latest U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. The U.S. continues to make these arms sales to Taiwan. The government in Beijing always protests, but this is just part of the U.S. stance. And so I think it would be astonishing if President Obama did not meet with the Dalai Lama at all. And right. That would be a real change in policy. So I think is what the government in Beijing has foreseen.
Well, and we want to talk more about China-U.S. relations. But meantime, how might the Dalai Lama, if he does, ask for help in his cause from the president?
I think the most important thing that President Obama and the U.S. government can do for the Dalai Lama right now is simply to meet with him. That is to show that, as with all of his predecessors over the past 30 years, that President Obama recognizes the legitimacy of the Dalai Lama himself as a world figure, which is something the Chinese government heavily disputes. They view him as a kind of closet subversive separatist, and they think that the West has been duped by his Nobel Prize and all of that. So I think just giving legitimacy and face, if you will, to the Dalai Lama is very important. There isn't anything tangible, really, that the U.S. or any other foreign powers can do about situations in Tibet.
Let's talk about U.S.-China relations, one of the most important relations in the world today and maybe more important, you know, going forward. The Chinese own how much of the U.S. now?
They have about $2 trillion in U.S. dollar-denominated assets. From their point of view, they have a lot of their savings in our basket.
Yes, they do. And so what are the concerns with that?
I think it's a legitimate concern, but not from the perspective we usually discuss it. I think it's a concern because this huge flow of Chinese savings into U.S. assets shows how imbalanced both of the economies have been over the past 10 years. The Chinese economy has been skewed towards overproduction and over-export reliance. The U.S. economy, as we all know, has been skewed towards over-borrowing, over-consumption, under-production, et cetera. So I think it's a measure of how kind of distorted the two economies have been. The brief way to say that I think we're not in the position, Americans, of having the landlord or the owner come and sort of throw us out of our dwellings because they have this $2 trillion debt is that really the Chinese are as vulnerable as we are. There's tremendous concern inside China of are their hard-earned savings safe?
Well, and there are other issues between the two countries as well. Hillary Clinton's criticism of internet censorship in China, many disputes at the climate talks in Copenhagen, China blocking a lot of the deals on pollution, and the disagreement currently over Iran. We just want to touch on that. The U.S. wants the U.N. Security Council to take stronger action, and it looks as if China is the only major power not on board with that.
I think this is an important and interesting development in several ways. From Chinese perspective, this is one of several signs that they're moving past the stage where they could just say, look, other countries' business are not our concern. We're just concerned with our own development. Don't bother us. We believe in this non-interventionist policy. As they become more and more significant a player around the world, they're going to be forced to take sides about Iran, about North Korea, about Burma, about many other issues. That's from the Chinese perspective. From the U.S. perspective, I think the strategy here is to recognize that while China is reluctant to take sides in issues like this, it can be not manipulated but played on by the fear of being isolated or embarrassed. And so, for example, if Russia joins other Western powers in applying sanctions to Iran, it then looks embarrassing for China if it's not joining this effort. And so, in a way, you get a two-for-one deal. If Russia can be persuaded to join this, then China eventually will too. But it's difficult because they have commercial interests there. They're wondering about their investments in Iran. How can they be made whole? So this is part of negotiating China into a more sort of responsible great power role.
Well, by the way, what about internal forces, the role of the internet? We mentioned Clinton's criticism of censorship, but how much of a force is that from within?
Interestingly, 10 years ago, most of us would have assumed and asserted that the internet would necessarily be a force for opening up within China. I think you could argue that over the last 10 years, on the whole, it's been a force for increased state control within China. The government, as is well known, has a very kind of sophisticated censorship program for the internet, which encourages most Chinese netizens to stay within the bounds of the government-supervised Chinese language internet. And so, in a way, it's made it harder for outside information to penetrate into China. It's, of course, a dynamic and fluid situation, but I think the optimism about techno democracy in China has come in for a hard second look.
And James Fallows, where do you stand on President Obama's tone towards China? Early on, he seemed not to want to ruffle China's feathers, again, not meeting with the Dalai Lama. But critics like John DeLurie of the Asia Society says that's just resulted in a more muscular, assertive China. What's your sense of how President Obama has walked this thin line?
I think the degree of change in both the U.S. and the Chinese policy over the last year has been perhaps exaggerated, and that, in fact, what's striking is the continuity on both sides. All presidents in the past 30 years have ended up with this balanced policy of looking for areas of cooperation and knowing their areas of real disagreement.
James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine, based in China for 3 years. His writings, again, Postcards from Tomorrow Square. We've been asking him about tomorrow's meeting between President Obama and the Dalai Lama and relations between the U.S. and China. Jim, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, quick bit of housekeeping. You can always listen to the show online, where you can also download a podcast or leave a comment. That's at hereandnow.org. Back with art critic Dave Hickey, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. The late artist Robert Mapplethorpe is back on the radar through a new memoir from his close friend Patti Smith. Well, art critic Dave Hickey says Mapplethorpe can never really go away. He endures, just like Norman Rockwell. Dave Hickey's manifesto of a book, The Invisible Dragon, Essays on Beauty, is the most read book by art students. It's been revised and reissued with a new chapter on American democracy because, Dave says, art must be democratic. He's a critic of what he calls the art establishment. He casts museums as zoos where when you visit, you can feel like you're looking at an animal trophy hanging on the wall. Dave Hickey joins us from the studios of KNPR in Las Vegas, Nevada. Dave, define beauty.
Well, beauty's a pleasant surprise. It's that moment that you find yourself rhyming with the world that's other than you.
Well, and also, you say Americans like to say something is beautiful to get consensus?
Yes, I think that the interesting thing about beauty is that we talk about it and that we want other people to think what we think is beautiful, that we choose our friends like that. You know, when I was a kid, it mattered whether you liked the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. These are social instruments.
Well, but you also ask, what does beauty do? What does it do?
It organizes society.
Not necessarily in a good way. You point to Helen of Troy.
Well, exactly. In a culture where beauty is given power, it will take you where it will. The first thing you learn is that Helen's face launched 1,000 ships, that anything that's really beautiful and attractive is something you should avoid, and you get all of these sort of prohibitions about following your instincts and your eyes.
You had no idea, really, the trouble you were stepping into when you wrote the essays in the book, all sparked, as you wrote, by the plague of dishonesty that infected every aspect of the controversy surrounding artist and photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. And in fact, you say his defenders were maybe as dishonest about that as his detractors.
Of course, they certainly were. What they wanted to do somehow was to say that these are beautiful, but they're not pornographic. But Robert's pornographic complicity in these pictures is a part of what they are. And so all of the defense of the museum director who was taken to trial about this was about how somehow we should see the formal beauty and not see what's really going on. I think that's intellectually dishonest.
Well, you said that conservative Senator Jesse Helms might actually have been more honest in his reaction.
Oh, certainly he was more honest. And to be honest, Robert had a long, a 20-year career with no problem at all until he went into the public sector. And I can understand why the senator might be a little bit upset at spending public money to shock his grandchildren. The issue of the public engagement in the private world of art is an extremely problematic one since it tends to censor the art that gets shown. It's not the subject. The subject rendered in a photograph tacked up on the wall unattractively doesn't bother anyway. Well, it's disguise, you know. But if it's beautiful, if it's got the shape and the elegance of a platinum print, then it's dangerous. If you understand.
Well, you're also famous or infamous for embracing Norman Rockwell.
Let me put it like this. I became the Rockwell guy and the Mapplethorpe guy for the same reason. I sat down one day and thought, if the art world didn't exist, who would still be famous artists? And Bob and Norman were the people who came to mind. Because they have a life in the memory of American people. Rockwell is long gone. His pictures are rarely reproduced. If I go into a freshman class and say, tell me an artist you know, they say Norman Rockwell. He exists. He survives all of the gentrification, as does Robert. And all Norman Rockwell does is do pictures of those moments in life that don't hurt. You know, there's no rule against that.
What is your main complaint with the art world?
Okay, nobody has the right to tell you what to look at. The pictures we look at because we want to. We've spent our life in this sort of clockwork orange, eyes clamped open world of art history classes where they show you slides and talk. That's not looking at art. When I go through an art museum with Peter Sheldahl or any of my art critic friends, we go real fast until something stops us. We look at what we want to, and we don't look at anything that we think, well, maybe if I looked at this, it would make me a better person. The thing about art, it's not about what's in it. It's about does this give me more than what that does? It's a comparison of objects. The more objects that you've seen, the more complex your experience is.
But for the rest of us who don't know where to look, you know, if the museums are, as you say, sort of captured animals, you know, hanging on the wall,
right,
where else do we look?
And my complaint with the museums is that they have gone into the fashion business. When I was a kid, I went to museums to see unfashionable work. That's where we put the stuff that we know is good, but is out of fashion. If we want to see fashionable work, we go to a gallery. Museums have gone into the fashion business in the very worst way, in the sense that they give the imprimatur of public seriousness to, you know, frivolous things that aren't going to last the night.
You say they become department stores.
What I'm saying is that museums are more market-driven than the market.
And so where do we go?
Well, one of my premises is that having grown up in an art world that was about the size of the jazz world, which is to say 7,000 heavily medicated people worldwide, everybody in it would know what art was about. And if you wanted to join it, you would have to find out about it. You would have to go hang out in places you've never hung out before if you wanted to see Miles Davis. And when Miles came on stage, no curator would walk out there and say, Miles is addressing issues of alterity in the global context. And yet artists who have the same level of radicality deal with this every day. Let me tell you a story. When I was a sophomore at Southern Methodist University, I used to study differential equations with these two guys from the Zuni Pueblo in New Mexico. So we would kind of explain our cultures to each other. And the Zuni guys understood everything but museums. He said, why do you keep this stuff? It's like, Zuni iconography has been steady for 5,000 years. You know, and if we changed it, we'd throw the other stuff away. So why do you keep this stuff? And I've thought about that ever since. And the point is, we keep it because we love it. We don't keep it because it's good. We keep it because at some point we thought about throwing it away and just couldn't do it.
Dave Hickey, his manifesto of a book, The Invisible Dragon, Essays on Beauty. And while reading, I had to Google Walter Pater's Preface to the Renaissance, Alfred H. Barr, who was founder of the Museum of Modern Art, and Foucault's Order of Things.
That's right. If it'll make you feel any better, I called up Paula Cooper's gallery the other day. I've known Paula for 20 years. And the girl who answered the phone had to Google me before she would put me through.
Oh, the book that has made him famous in most circles has been reissued with a new chapter on beauty in America. Dave, thanks so much for speaking to us.
My pleasure, Robin.